Thank you, everybody. My name is Alec. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a watch up here. It's an honor to be here and a real privilege and a treat. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a sobriety date. It's December 23rd, 1996. I have a home group, it's a Midtown group in Kensington, Maryland. And I have a sponsor, and I talked to him today. And I called him. I needed to call him. I told him I was afraid of something. Not this, not speaking here. Something else was bugging me last night. And he gave me a great spiritual answer. He said, you should have called me last night. I'm having a good time in sobriety. And I hope you guys are too. And if you're not, I hope we can show you a way to be sober and comfortable and happy like we are. I hope we can share that with you. I don't know. And if you're new, and again, I'm not a regular at this group. I don't know. There's a lot of faces I do know, but I don't know everybody here. I don't know who's maybe newer, having a tougher time. But we hope you stick with us and find what we've found here. I found an answer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to try and talk about that in the way that we do here. I'm having a good time in sobriety. I mean, I'm in phase two of sobriety. If you're new, your sponsor might not have told you. Phase one, you get sober. Phase two, you get to stay here if you're willing to change and grow spiritually. That's it. There's no phase three. Ian might be in phase three. He's weird. We're praying for him. But I'm at the point in my sobriety where I hope I get to stay here and I'm willing to grow spiritually and I'm willing to change so that I can continue to live the best life that I've ever known. My sponsor is great. And I'm going to quote my sponsor a lot. He's great at saying things like, you know, if in here wasn't better than out there, I'd be out there. That's how you'd know. But it's better in here. So I'm going to tell you about my drinking. I'm going to tell you about what happened, maybe a little bit about what I'm like now, although it doesn't matter quite so much. People come to AA. I came to AA because I needed to know, what do you do? What do you do? I'm tired of feeling the way that I feel. Is it possible to feel differently? And I hope we can answer the big question for you. If you have alcoholism, there is a question that your life depends upon. And the question is, looking around a room like this, what do I have in common with these people? If you're an alcoholic of my type, I didn't know it, but my life depended on the answer to that question. What do I have in common with these people? If you stay sober a while, and I've stayed sober longer than I thought I would, you start to develop opinions. I'm sorry, it can't be helped. And I do sometimes share them. I have too many opinions. But one of my opinions is, it's our job to create an environment where a newcomer walks in and says something that's completely unimaginable for an alcoholic. The newcomer will say to themselves, these people understand how I feel. And if we can create an atmosphere of recovery like that, and somebody walks in and says, not only are these people doing better than I am, but they understand how I feel, then I think we can reach people. And that's, in a nutshell, kind of what happened to me. My sobriety date is in the month of December. That was scored as a January. I came in January, and it took me about 11 months to get sober. And I'll tell my story if I got it. We do that. We tell our story a little bit. But, you know, I came to AA and it wasn't for me. And that's fine. A lot of people come in not sure if AA is for them. That was my experience. Let me do my drinking. I'll do it real fast. I can get through it pretty fast. I've done this a bunch of times. I got sober. I grew up in a small town in Maine, Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Lovely little town on the water. And by small, I mean two lighthouses and no stoplights. Nice. We're talking small town, which is fine. It's a great place to be from, great place to grow up. A lot of fun, you know, sledding in the winter and all that stuff. And, you know, I don't know, but I just had this feeling I was destined for bigger and better things than what Cape Elizabeth, Maine could offer me. And, you know, and I needed to get out from under the thumb of the Cape Elizabeth Police Department. And, you know, so my parents were divorced and it was fine. They divorced when I was very, very young. And I've learned in sobriety, you know, better to grow up in two peaceful homes than one war zone. It worked out just fine for me. But I grew up with my mom mostly, and she traveled a lot. She supported us a lot financially. And you know, I didn't like to actually, I'm going to, my brain bounces around a lot, so try to stay with me. One thing the Big Book says is be quick to see where religious people are right and make use of what they have to offer. So something that I picked up along the way from somebody who's religious that has nothing to do with alcoholism. He was talking about himself and he said, I didn't know it at the time, but the day that I was born, I won four lotteries all at once. My parents, my zip code, my health, and my aptitudes, which is kind of my story. I woke up looking back. I was born under pretty good circumstances, but I'll tell you what, I looked at the circumstances of my life and I instantly knew I'd gotten a bad deal as a kid growing up. When we talk about being restless, irritable, and discontent. And I mostly relate with being discontent. I was completely not content with my circumstances. I didn't like the hand that I had been dealt. I was good at school, bad at sports, couldn't talk to girls, uncomfortable around people, had the nerd package before before nerds took over the world. I wish they had told me that, you know. It was all going to work out for my people. But I had the nerd package, so I was very uncool as a little kid, and I couldn't stand it. I hated it, you know. And I can't, when you come to AA, and people are like, it got so bad that I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. And I'm like, man, I felt like that in fourth grade. Nothing to do with drinking. I just hated myself from early on. But my mom's traveling, and I don't know, one day it just occurred to me, the corner cabinet in the kitchen has liquor in it. I don't know. I mean, I'd known that my whole life, but one day I was like, the liquor cabinet has liquor. You know, it was like an epiphany, and my mom was out on the road. And she had the non-alcoholics liquor cabinet, bottle of peach schnapps from 1974, like, you know, I mean, just, you know. Stuff that people had brought over as a gift and hadn't been touched. It's probably still there, half watered down from me in the 90s. But, you know, one week my mom was on the road and I just started stealing mom's booze. And I went full CIA black ops. You know, you look at the levels, you go for the clear liquid because you can refill it with water as if my mom's dusting for prints, which she wasn't. Maybe that came later. But, you know, so I got good and drunk on my mom's stolen booze. That was it. And as I explain it now in sobriety, once I knew how I could feel after I stole mom's liquor, how could I ever be okay with sobriety? How could the way that I feel in the morning ever be enough when all I have to do is steal mom's booze? And to me, where the book says my life seems the only normal one, that made perfect sense to me. Someday I'll pin down a non-alcoholic and find out what it is that keeps them from drinking in the morning. But that's never something that I had to wrestle to overcome. I was just ready for it. I was ready to steal mom's booze. I was ready to get drunk. I was ready to be drunk. And sooner or later, my peers caught up with me. And then in high school, everybody's drinking. And alcohol introduced me to being a part of the crowd that I had always wanted to be a part of, and which was fine. And we had, you know, there were some fun times in there. The times when other people were drinking overlapped with when I was drinking, which was always. And then Monday mornings in high school were great because that was when all the war storytelling would start. You know, who got in trouble and who threw up and who broke up with who and hooked up with who and who rolled cars and all this stuff. And so Monday morning was like, there was that one little, there was like 3 weekends in my whole drinking that were just terrific. And then everything else was a disaster. But somehow I latched onto those 3 weekends. So everybody, and I'll go quick through this. All the guys that I drank with in high school drank like alcoholics. So are within my little crew, we find ourselves. And the people that I drank with, the ones that were rolling cars, getting suspended, getting expelled, getting into fights, spending nights in jail, going to detoxes, going to rehabs. That was the normal, that was the way that we lived. And nothing seemed too unusual about that. And most of us got introduced to AA at some point, and we'd have, you know, God bless, your best friend's going to rehab tomorrow party, which is, you know, going out of business. Everything must go. And that was always a great one. And you knew 28 days later, the welcome home from rehab party, right? You know? And so we're talking about AA in a very circumspect kind of way. Like, hey, there is a place where people go called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was to get introduced to it long before I would have looked for AA myself. It's a weird story, and I tell it just because it's so bizarre. You will not find it in working with others as a great way to carry on the message. My best buddy, so I'll say this, in the mid-90s, which is when I got sober, there were maybe 2 million people in AA. And I can tell you with certainty, there was exactly one member of Alcoholics Anonymous who was credible to me. And it was the guy that I drank with. He was a year older than me. He was kind of like my drinking sponsor. I'm still in high school. I'm a senior. He's off to college. He's a year older than me. And he invites me. He's like, Alec, it's time. You're ready for your first college party. And man, I never felt more ready for anything in my life. I drove from Maine to the University of Vermont in Burlington, crossed the White Mountains of New Hampshire in a snowstorm in January in a car that was missing fifth gear. It's a long story. But and I got there. And this is the part that's not in working with others. When I got there ready for my first college party, my friend said, I wasn't fully honest with you about this weekend. I'm in a sober living dorm. I go to AA. I think you might have a drinking problem. Would you like to come to an AA meeting with me? And I'll tell you, if my car could make it home, I would. You'd have a different speaker tonight. But it was an old Volvo, and it had a fuse panel right by my left knee. And I don't know what your budget was like when you were drinking, but I didn't have fuse money and drinking money, and so I had one fuse that I could switch back and forth whether I needed heat or wipers. And that's what the drive was like to Vermont. So when he said, "Would you like to go to AA with me?" I surrendered, and I can joke about it now. Because happily ever after, but at the time it was a pretty uncomfortable moment. And yet at the same time, this was the one person who had drank with me. He was, you know, brothers in arms. That's what our drinking friends are like. And here's the crazy thing. He went to a meeting and picked up his 24-hour chip. This guy was not crushing it in AA, but he knew. And I tell you, what a great messenger. What, how great is that for me to see somebody who's like, man, I'm hurting bad. And you know what I do? I go to AA and they let me come and they let me pick up a chip. And so this guy gave me the information that I needed at the time. And I use this sometimes because I meet plenty of people that aren't really ready for sobriety, which is fine. You don't have to be. He let me know how to find AA. I didn't know. I thought maybe it was a secret society. He showed me where there was a men's meeting every day at noon in my hometown, Portland, Maine. And he said, you don't have to sign up for anything. There's no commitment. There's no membership fees. You don't have to put money in the basket if you don't have it. You can even take their coffee and then not put money in the basket. And he said, you don't need to be sober to go to an AA meeting as long as you don't disrupt it, which I desperately needed to know. And that might be part of the reason I'm sober today, because on my sobriety date, I wasn't sober, but I knew I could go to an AA meeting if I didn't disrupt it. I didn't have to be sober, but I just could sit quietly. And so that was the beginning of the last year of my drinking. It's the worst year of my life. I thought the answer was getting out of mom's house and going off to college. I'd seen Animal House. I'm not stupid. I knew that's what the answer is. Clearly, you know, I was ready to pursue my education. And I thought the answer was get out of mom's house, get out from under the thumb of all these authority figures and stop having to hide my drinking and lie about it and keep track of what I'm telling who and just be able to drink like a gentleman. It made perfect sense at the time, you know, and so I got out of mom's house and it wasn't the answer. And I started drinking any day that I could get my hands on it around the clock when I could. I got on the path that leads to expulsion. But I'd been to AA and I started trying to find AA meetings in town. So I owned a big book. I was a drunken big book owner. That's the worst. I brought my big book to college with me in case I developed alcoholism. A hint, that's super weird. Nobody does that. That's super bizarre. And so I'm like in the dorm and I'm not a pass out drinker. So every night I'm in bed, the room's spinning. I'm thinking about my big book that I got hidden on the bookshelf. And I'm thinking, how do we get here again? This was supposed to be the one you need like 2 weekends and you could turn the whole thing around. It was supposed to like, what happened? Yeah. And, it does say in working with others, tell people how baffled you were. And I was baffled. I was really trying everything I could to manage my drinking. I wanted more than anything to get to stay in the dorms, to get out, to stay out of mom's house, to have a social life, to be a part of the drinking crowd, to be one of the fun, good spirits. I just wanted to have a good time, just lighten up a little bit. And here I am. I can't stop thinking about AA. I can't stop drinking myself sick. And I'm throwing up behind dumpsters, trying to pretend like everything's fine. And I can't stop thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I talked to one of my buddies in high school and he goes, you know, people who aren't alcoholic probably don't wonder whether or not they have alcoholism. And that got me. That's one of those that I wished I could have forgotten, but it stuck with me. And every night I'd be thinking about that. I'm probably not an alcoholic. I don't know why. I have no evidence to support that, but I don't feel like one. And I don't want to have alcoholism. I don't want AA to be the answer. I know there's this place where people go where they stop drinking. And I want more than anything to not be one of them. And I came back to AA because I failed to not come back, if that makes sense. I tried everything I could to stay away from AA. And the chips were down, and it was the only place I knew of where people could go and stop drinking. And I came back. That's how bad. You want to know how bad my drinking was? I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's pathetic. That's how bad it was, you know. And I came up, my sobriety date's December 23rd. Can you pick a worse time? I mean, even then, you're like, you could have just dragged it out for 8 more days, you know, Christmas, New Year's. No, it was over. I was done. I've been lying to my parents the whole time. I knew the report card was coming. Have you ever lied when you know you're going to get caught? Like, this isn't going to work, but I'm going to do it anyway, just to stay limber. And I'm telling them school is going great. Meanwhile, you know, I would, those last months, I would, The phone would ring, I'd wake up, the clock would say like seven something, and I wouldn't know if it was AM or PM. I wouldn't know if it was like Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Saturday morning, Monday morning. You know, I was a weekend drinker, and in college, the weekend starts Wednesday evening and goes until Wednesday morning. So I ended up back in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't like AA. I didn't respect the people here. I didn't want to be here, but I didn't know anywhere else where I could go. And that's the magical story of my, that's the end of my drinking. That's what I was able to accomplish on my own. Everything from that day to this is AA's results. I told you where my results got me to December 22nd, 1996. The bed spinning, my sister, remember when she found me drinking one morning, and with this she was, I'll tell you, she would have been disgusted if she didn't care so much about me. So she was disgusted and scared, telling me that I had a drinking problem, that I was an alcoholic. And I'm like, this is a wine cooler. This isn't even really drinking. I don't know why you're so upset about that. Right. It's funny now. It's funny then. And that was to be the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous and a new life. I believe we get to live two lives in one lifetime. And that was the beginning of my new life in Alcoholics Anonymous. It didn't get awesome right away, for sure. Early sobriety was not great. And a lot of, there was a lot of self-pity. I had a lot of self-pity. I was 19 when I got sober, and I just felt like, why me? Why me, man? You know, not, and there wasn't a lot of alcoholism in my immediate family. I didn't say that. Like, my parents had no tools for somebody like me. They had no idea what was in their midst. They had no understanding and no ability to deal with this kind of stuff that I was throwing at the family. I mean, the mood swing, like not just the drinking, but everything else that comes along with it, the mood swings, the lying, inexplicable car damage, you know, everything else, right? They'd have meetings about me. I don't know if you remember this, the meetings about you that you're not invited to, where decisions get made about what are we going to do about Alec, and then you find out what the decision is afterward, you know, waiting for the verdict. And they had no tools for somebody like me. AA knew what to do, though. So I was 19. I didn't like, I felt sorry for myself. I felt like the best years of my life had been taken away from me. Why not my sister? Why couldn't she have alcoholism? I mean, her drinking is so boring anyway. You know, but it was me. And I thought, you know, there's got to be a way. I own a big book, and I'm pretty good with books, you know, not to brag. I could probably just skim through this and then kind of just get on with life. That's really what I was shooting for. And I got bad news, if that's what you're here for. There's one thing on the menu in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sad to report. And it's a life of sacrifice, unfortunately, service for others, being willing to grow spiritually, like I was talking about, living differently, living unselfishly, turning my back on a life of self-centeredness and sacrificing much of my free time in carrying this message to other people. I get changed along the way. That must happen. I must be a different person. But when that happens, I can go to somebody new and say, guess what? I'm not the same guy I used to be. There's a lot that's same about me. You know, my fingerprints will still come up. But my relationships are different. The way I treat people is different. The way I feel when the phone rings and I don't recognize the number is different. The way I feel when I open my mail is different. The relationships that I have. Do you ever play the game when you look in your rearview mirror and you're driving? Is that a light bar or a roof rack? You play that game, right? That's different. So I can drive without that level of fear. And I'm a different person because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not immune from drinking. It's one of the worst parts about alcoholism. It's what it can do to people, even who are in the middle. You can always go back there. But the process has changed me, and I'm able to look people in the eye and tell them, hey, look, I'm not the same person. So there's a reason I'm a guy, I believe. I needed a drink. The conditions of my life set me up for needing a drink. The way that I treated people and the way that I felt about myself made me want to drink. And the way that I felt about the consequences of my drinking made me want to drink to get away from the consequences of my drinking. And very sick people are nodding because you understand. That's no good. That is a setup. It's hard to get off that hamster wheel. And the way that I feel now is very, very, very different from how I felt when I was drinking. That's the result of actions that I've taken in AA. We've got a process. We have a way of living. As far as I know, it's really the only way to manufacture that kind of change, that kind of personality change that brings about recovery from alcoholism. So I'll talk about that for a little bit if I can. I wasn't hot and heavy on our 12-step program. I don't know if you're like me, came to your first meeting and do all 12 steps in 45 seconds. It can be done, right? You just bang through them all. You sift out the ones that aren't necessary. If you're intelligent and emotionally sensitive, you can dispense with a lot of that. Just work your way through. And I thought, most of these I'm not going to need to do. I'm going to be on some sort of advanced track. But I related to the idea of powerlessness, and it surprised me because I'd never considered that that was my problem. I had a lot of problems, authority figures, emotionally sensitive, smarter than the average bear, you know, not understood by the people around me, bad at sports. And but I'd never considered powerlessness was a problem. I had drank at many problems, at many people, at many circumstances in my life. And it kind of sort of always seemed like something that I had decided to do along the way. I'm a guy that quit drinking many, many times. I don't mean to brag. I'm really good at quitting drinking. I've done it many, many times. My record is 3 times in 1 day. You can quit forever 3 times in 1 day. If you start early, it can be done. Not to brag, I'm pretty good. And so every time I started drinking again, it kind of sort of looked like something I had chosen to do. But I never considered that maybe I was powerless and that maybe it really wasn't the kind of thinking that served me. And it was just kind of a knee-jerk reaction. It was crawling into a bottle makes sense to me somewhere deep down inside where I don't even have words to describe it. But when life, when I am backed into a corner, that's where I will go. And there's some part of my lizard brain that hasn't forgotten that. So I try to live differently now and not get in those desperate circumstances. I try to find other ways to act. Now I got to the second step, and that was a big, big, big problem, you guys. This is, we're talking big problem. You thought you were sneaky with your power greater than yourself, right? Like, I can't see through that. But you capitalized the P. So now I know you're going to try and brainwash me here, you know. And I had a lot of problem with the second step. And I only talk about it so much in sobriety because it meant so much to me over time to be able to make peace with the second step. I found a power greater than myself here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hold on to your hats because I'm going to share it with you right now. This is going to blow your minds. You ready? The power is, if I do what people in AA do today, I don't have to take a drink today. Man, that'll change your life. That may work for you and it may not, but it worked for me. And I desperately needed an answer. Now, all the other stuff that comes behind it about being willing to grow spiritually, being able to have conscious contact with a power greater than yourself, it might require a little more than that little cornerstone that I gave you. If I do what people in AA do today, I don't have to take a drink today. But my mind is open to that. I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to put time into prayer and meditation for the purpose of conscious contact. I need something that's going to change me. It's not just high-fiving God. I need to be a different person. My progress has been so frustratingly, aggravatingly slow there. It's been awful. I'm glad we're not scored on that. I put time into it, and sometimes I feel like nothing's coming back. And but I'll tell you, I have a bedrock belief that Alcoholics Anonymous is a place that has a solution for alcoholism. And when my problem is powerlessness, I need to find a way to access a power greater than myself. For me, that starts in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe that. And I'm willing to do the work to grow along those lines. I will digress. This is a metaphor, but bear with me. One time I tried sports, did indoor track in 8th grade. I don't know. All you had to buy was shoes. It was cheap. I was terrible at it. And I competed in one event one time, 440, quarter mile. It's not a bad track event if you are fast or have stamina. I'm 0-for-2 there. It's not great. It's big, you know, one of those big track meets. And I was the guy who's dead last, you know, the guy who came in first is already in his street shoes. I'm still coming around the back half. But here's what you'll notice. When somebody is losing that badly, the crowd eats it up and they start clapping for you and they're like, you can do it, which they don't say to the people that they're sure can do it. You know, they're taking a chance. They love it. They eat it up. They clap way more for you than the guy that wins. It's kind of like saying, keep coming back after you share. It's like, you know, a little embarrassing. And that was my indoor track career. I was the guy that came in last and the crowd went wild. And I hope God's like that. I hope God looks at me or somebody like me who's trying and is pathetically, embarrassingly slow and is riddled with belligerence and defiance and know-it-allness and a bad attitude. And I hope God is going, you can do it, man. I hope. I sure need that. I hope I'm not judged on my progress, but on the effort that I put into it. Because I don't know that I'm that much further along than I was when I started. I don't know, but I'm willing. I'm willing to do the stuff that people in AA do. And I hope that's what God's like. If any of you meet him, let me know. But I'm going to need something like that. And I'm pretty sick. And that's how I made my peace with the second step. I found that it's one size fits all. I've met thousands of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found anybody who's ineligible to find some sort of power here. And people come in all kinds of broken, in all kinds of ways that are unacceptable. Things that shouldn't happen to people through organized religion or awful experiences as a kid, or feeling abandoned, or tried God and couldn't connect, or, you know, drank through all of it. And everybody that comes through the door that I've seen that sincerely tries can find a way to make peace with that and can find an ability to sit down and reach out and try and see what's there and try and grow a little bit. That's my observation. You disagree with me after the meeting if you want. That's what I've been seeing. Well, I've been here. The second step is one size fits all. And when the second step is firmly anchored in my mind, why wouldn't I move on? Why wouldn't I go through the third step? Why wouldn't I turn my life over to somebody that has the ability to help me and wants to and loves me and wants the best for me? That's a no-brainer. I thought the third step was going to be hard until I had a second step in place. And then it was skipping along, right? Except for the stuff that I'm in charge of. That's different. You know, like God's on standby for a lot of that stuff. But, you know, I'm a work in progress. I had to continue with the rest of the steps. It's not a three-step program. I had to take my inventory, which was tough because I had to start my inventory and then I had to work on it and then I had to finish it. I've started a lot of things in life, but I wasn't a finisher when I came to AA. And I don't know if this is exaggeration, but I'm not sure that there's anything in my life up until that point that I had started and put 100% effort into and worked on it until it was done. I don't know. I'm such a corner cutter. But I did that for the first time with my fourth step. I wasn't fast. I wasn't awesome. My sponsor, you know, he invited me over to his house. And I think the implication was I can leave when it's done. But I got to come over to his house and work on my fourth step. And I did it thoroughly. And I was afraid of drinking again. And that might have motivated me. It's not a bad motivation to be afraid of drinking again. I was really scared. I didn't want to go back to where I came from. And I shared all those things with my sponsor. You know, I shared my resentments. I shared my fears. I shared my sex conduct where I'd been selfish through all of those. I was riddled with fear. And I made the fears list. And I'll talk about that briefly. It's in the book. Not everybody catches it. It's funny. Not everybody does. But I think this is a good group. People really probably follow the text pretty closely. But there's a section that I hadn't noticed all the times that I'd read it, where it talks about our fears. We set them on paper, even though we had no resentment and connection with them. We asked ourselves why we had these fears. And then I was given the key. The key was the fear prayer. Everybody that I sponsor knows the fear prayer. And I went back through that list after sharing it with my sponsor, and he had me. This seems really unnecessary, you guys. It's ridiculous what they make you do here. For every fear I had listed on paper, I had to say, God, please remove my fear of fear. And direct my attention to what you'd have me be. I had to do it for every single one of them. And for the rest of my life, when I catch myself being afraid, I still use that prayer. Last night, this morning, God, please remove my fear of financial insecurity and direct my attention to what you would have me be. It's not a gimme. It's not just make me a fearless person. Make me somebody who is invulnerable to fear. Show me how I'm supposed to live instead. Show me what I'm supposed to do. That's what AA's always done for me with the problems that I bring in. My sponsor's been a great one. When I tell him something that's going on, at first it was put away a chair. I don't like AA. I don't like the people here. I'm not comfortable. Okay, great. We've got a job for people like that. We need you to put away chairs. Go do that. Right? Put away chairs, right? And it actually, honestly, that worked for me because I was putting away chairs super fast and super angry and nobody talks to you. You're that guy. It's like armor. I could just wear four chairs, like a suit of armor. But I began to feel that AA was a place for me as well. That critical question, what do I have in common with these people? I started making friends in AA. I started to respect the men in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd always gotten along better with women. I wasn't great with the dudes. I was better with the women. I felt like I was in competition with every guy I met and I didn't measure up. So why would you hang out with people like that? I started making guy friends, started hanging out with them before the meeting, started doing service, started to build a life for myself. And I wasn't really sure where the sixth and seventh step were going, but I just spent basically a year calling my sponsor with a crisis every day. And the details of my inventory started to emerge and my shortcomings of what I brought to the party every day. The crises that I was bringing to my sponsor were self-manufactured every time. We spent about a year on that before he'd let me go. And the problem was I wasn't getting well very quickly. I was getting well, but it wasn't, you know, I wasn't speed running sobriety. And my sponsor was getting me ready to make amends to the people around me. But before I could do that, I needed to be able to go to him and say, I'm a different person and I'm willing to have a relationship on a different basis. So I had to do some of the growing up there. That's why it took some time. He was a qualified member of AA who recognized that I hadn't really gotten all that well. When the time was right, with adult supervision, we made an 8-step list. We went back to my 4-step, pulled out some names, where my selfishness had been hurtful. And it's funny, I didn't want to do the 8-step list. And my sponsor laughed at me and he said, "That's because it's a 2-part step, in case you failed to notice that." We made the list and then we became willing. He said, "Of course you're not willing. You haven't made a list. Willingness is for list makers." And he was right. And if the 4th and 5th step showed me how screwed up my thinking was, writing out the 8th step showed me how terribly I treated the people around me. If you had me in your life when I was drinking, you got a bad deal. Loving me and trusting me was a bad return on investment. You did not get what you put into it. And so the people that loved me and trusted me had to go on the list first. My parents, my family, people I stole from, companies I worked for, that kind of thing, a bunch of things. Guy I stole a car from. So it's not that dramatic. It was a friend of the family. He sold me a car. He didn't understand alcoholics because he sold me a car with a payment plan and he gave me the car after the first payment. At that point, why would you make payments? You already have a car. And he was a well-to-do guy. He didn't really need the money. But he was also no fool. And when I called him in sobriety, he had no problem accepting that check. He was like, ready. I thought it was going to be a big deal there. And I've been sober a while. I filed my taxes. I got a bunch of money back. And I just called the guy. And he's like, "Yeah, check will be fine." And I can't even remember his name now. But I used to think about that guy all the time, especially in amends meetings, you know. So, because, you know, this is how we deal with stuff like that. Say, "Hey, you know, he's well to do. He didn't need the money." Right? Right? I think. And that it was that doubt. It's like, "Yeah, but what if I bump into him? A guy like that can afford a private investigator. He can come find me." And I made amends. I did the same thing with my dad. I was in a position to pay him back $several thousand, kind of in one shot. I remember this one. I mailed it to him. I didn't even tell him it was coming. I wrote what my sponsor said, put it in a card, write him a check. "Hey, this is what I owe you. This is what it's for." Dropped in the mail. And I remember he called me one afternoon. He came home from work, opened the mail. And he said, "Alec," my dad's an incredibly warm, very principled guy. And he said, "You know, I have some beliefs about parenting." He said, "I don't, you know, parents not a bank. I don't think we loan money to our children. I've given you money your whole life. I don't expect it back. It's all this money that you think you owe me. I've never expected any of that back." It's like I could feel the money flowing back into my checking account. And he said, "But if this is for your sobriety, I will cash that check." What a man. Man with character. Man who wanted the best for me. And I got my money's worth. I was free. All that stuff that I had done it was in the past. And it wasn't in the past because I didn't want to talk about it. It was in the past because we agreed we're moving on. The balance is paid. The ledger is wiped clean. Our relationship today is about today. It's not about the drinking I did in the 90s that he's still pissed off about. It's not. That stuff, it has its rightful place in our family. My dad sends me a card every year on my anniversary. He's a huge fan of AA. I bought him a big book once for Christmas because I was broke and I was in college and big books were like $4. And I was like, "This is going to seem really meaningful." He read it. He just read the big book. He thought it'd be cool to understand what I was going through. So our family started to get well. I talked in a roundabout way about prayer and meditation. That's something that I've come to embrace. The version of me after I pray and meditate is much easier to get along with. The world deserves better than what they get when I wake up in the morning. So I have a practice of prayer and meditation. And again, I think that is not to save my soul, but it's to set me up to do better 12-step work again. So I can go to people and say, "Hey, you know, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I felt awful. I hated what I saw when I looked in the mirror and I don't feel that way. And here's what I do differently to feel differently. And you don't have to feel this way ever again." I think that gives me some credibility when I talk to people about that. Sometimes things happen that are unacceptable to me. You know, they're awful things. My wife, when our daughter was 2 weeks old, my wife had a heart attack. I was not consulted. That wasn't part of my plan. It was unacceptable to me. And I had to carry on. That was a tough time. But the AA Army showed up for us. We had a doctor in our group who called out of her day job and came to our hospital to like help advocate for us. And my mom was helping us with the baby and I go to the hospital. Once or twice I got in a meeting, take care of the baby, relieve my mom. And I was like a frenzied robot. And then in between, there'd be these little 5 or 10 minutes in the car where it's just me and my head going crazy. Wasn't a great time for me. It's hard to just sort of pray your way out of that one. But things worked out. The good news is my wife is fine. The baby's fine. She's 14. Everybody's kicking butt. We're having a great time now. What happens when you go through enough of those circumstances, you become that obnoxious kind of old timer. And the old timers will do this thing. You go to them with a problem and they'll say, well, things are going to be okay, which is unacceptable. Like, how dare they? How dare they say that with their psychic gifts, right? How dare they say that things are going to be okay? And here's my spin on that. I've been through enough things, and here's what I've learned. No matter what has happened to me, sooner or later, and I don't know if it's days, weeks, months, or years, there comes a point where I look around and I go, you know, things are okay. I didn't. What I learned, and I'll pass this on to you, is that I can tell you things will be okay, not because I know the specifics of how things are going to work out, but I know things are going to be okay for you, maybe in a version of okay that you haven't considered before. I mean, look at my life. Suburban dad, kill me. It's the worst. You know, things are fantastic in my life. They're okay. They're better than okay. You know, dad, father of a teenager, which is going fantastically well, might I add. Madly in love with my wife, who's sober in AA a long time. We have a peaceful home. There's a lot of laughter in our house. It's a safe place. It's a loving place. We've introduced AA in a way that our daughter doesn't think is too weird. You know, she's kind of working with it. And my life is okay. And it's, in fact, much better than okay. But when things come up, I have to look around and go, you know, things are going to be okay. I've made it this far. One of my friends likes to say, you know, God didn't carry us this far, it only carry us this far. And that's been a great comfort to me in times. But over time, when I go through enough of these things, yeah, things are going to be okay. I don't know what okay looks like. Man, someday I'll look around and I'll go, yeah, things are okay. Things are okay. We've had all the ups and downs that life throws at you. I'm going to go for a few minutes here just for fun, just because there's nothing better that I like in the world. Going to talk quickly about the traditions, if that's okay with the powers that be. I'll just throw a little, sprinkle a little bit of that on there because I've gotten well in Alcoholics Anonymous. So now I'm going to bore you all to death. What happens first after you're sober a couple of years, some well-intentioned newcomer asks if you will lead a meeting on the traditions. And if you're like me, you're too proud to say, I don't know. And so you just say yes. And then you go home and furiously, like, oh God, what do I say about the traditions? Right? You know, you kind of bluff your way through some traditions. If you do it enough time, you start to pick up on some stuff. So I started reading the traditions and getting into that. And then during the COVID pandemic, we got super weird studying the AA literature. And I had a lot of time to look at that. I'll give you my take on the traditions. I'm certainly not authorized to speak on behalf of AA. I'm not a spokesman or anything like that. But this is just my two cents on this. The history of AA's traditions. I mean, how is it even? But so, first of all, we have to consider that nobody invented Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody sat down and said, we need to come up with a way to fix drugs. This was people who are dying. And we were looking for an answer. And we happened to find a way of life that's grounded in a spiritual basis that involves working with other alcoholics. And it turns out, as a bizarre side effect, that's the solution for alcoholism. Nobody could have had any idea that it worked that way, but it did. And somewhere along the way, we had to find out to take, I don't know, arguably the weirdest people in the world, people like Ian, and put them together in a fellowship and not have us all go crazy and murder each other. And so, you know, I don't know if you ever looked at a can of spray paint that has the label, like, don't spray this in your eyeball. The traditions are kind of like that. Like, every rule tells a story. And we found out along the way, there are some things that groups of alcoholics probably should do and probably shouldn't do if they're going to stay together. And so, yeah, we have a that's a saying in our household. Every rule tells a story, and there's some weird ones out there. And so I've looked at AA's traditions and where do these come from? And if you start getting into the history of it, you can find out. I have a couple of questions that I think people need to ask themselves about each tradition when you look at it. Say, you know, I wonder why we had this tradition. What would have been a good intention that set us up to need this tradition? What were we trying to protect? And it turns out we needed a tradition to protect us from that instead of from the good intentions. What is this? What do I have to give up? I have to give up something in every tradition. I have to be willing to give something up. And by the way, if I can, I'm going to talk about tradition three, tradition five. That's kind of all I got time for today. I have to give something up. And then the last question, what does this have to do with AA unity? You know, we go back and forth about anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Underlying part of it. I go really heavy on unity being really important. I think when you get into it, unity, anonymity, making it not about me, it's kind of the snake eating its own tail. It's kind of hard to tell where one stops and one begins because I've got to get me out of the way for our common welfare. So you can ask, what does this have to do with anonymity? It might be more practical to say, what does this have to do with unity? It's a great way to look at the tradition. So I'm going to talk about the third tradition really briefly. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, which isn't the third tradition. That's the short form of the third tradition. I'm going to read the long form of the third tradition. If I can find it here. Long form says, our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover, nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. So it says, our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. We should exclude nobody. So the third tradition is a door that's open, and it says, if you have alcoholism, there's a place for you in Alcoholics Anonymous. Period. There's no other qualification. You don't need to have money. I heard this story. I don't know if it's true. I heard it when I was visiting in Akron. They said in the earliest days of AA, there was a controversy in New York. There was a guy that wanted to be an AA member, and the AA members weren't sure if he was going to take AA seriously. They weren't sure if he was desperate enough to accept the AA program. And the reason was he owned a wristwatch. And they said, how can you have bottomed out and lost everything if you still own a wristwatch? How can you be desperate enough? And this was a big deal in New York AA. And they found a compromise because it turns out the man had been institutionalized. And I guess somehow those cancel out. They're like, we'll take you, Mr. Wristwatch, you know, Mr. Top Hat and Monocle, your wristwatch. The third tradition says, come on in. In the 12 and 12, it talks about somebody who came to AA in the earliest days with an addiction that was even more stigmatized. And they were asking themselves, should we let this person in? Now, remember, what's the good intention behind this that makes it necessary? The intention is we have to protect AA. We can't let the wrong kind of people in here. They're going to screw up the thing that our lives depend upon, right? That seems like a very good motive. We must protect AA. Can you imagine the kind of people that would come to Alcoholics Anonymous if we just let everybody with alcoholism in? And for years I read that and I just knew, I didn't know it all. I didn't need to check this with anybody. I just assumed they were talking about somebody who's addicted to heroin. It's talking about an addiction that was even worse stigmatized than alcoholism. It turns out that wasn't it. He was a sexual deviant, which is less interesting than it sounds. It actually just means he was gay, but it was illegal back then. It sounds super cool. But they were like, what are we going to do? Are we going to let this person into Alcoholics Anonymous? What will people think? And what they realized, and sorry for the joke there, I was trying to make light of it. Probably I should be a little more serious about it, but they realized to deny somebody with alcoholism recovery in AA is to be judge, jury, and executioner. Now, it sounds good on paper, but what is it really like? I don't know how it is here, but sometimes where I go to meetings, there are people who are not cooperative. There are people who are loud and disruptive. There are people with psychiatric problems apart from alcoholism. And sometimes I will admit that I think, you know, this meeting might be better without that person. That's tough. That's tough. We had a guy who molested his own kid. That's unacceptable to anybody. And the people in our group said, that guy better not come back here. I'll kill him if I see him here. Well, if you're keeping somebody out of AA, you may very well be killing him. And I don't want to make light of this, but I want to say sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's hard when we want to protect Alcoholics Anonymous. It means so much to me. I owe my life to this fellowship. And I want meetings to be a certain way. I want people to act a certain way. I want an atmosphere of recovery, and I want people to act right so that when newcomers come in, they see that we're different, and not everybody is in line with that. Oh, burns me up. I hope you don't have people like that here. Don't comply, non-compliant rebels, non-conformists. It's challenging. The third step says, I may exclude none who wish to recover, provided they have alcoholism. I must give them a welcome. I must bring them on in. Now, how do I put that into practice? It's hard for me to say, I must be welcoming. I'm going to be over here talking to my friends. I hope somebody else gets the new guy, because that's the other side of that message. If the door is truly open, it's not good enough to say, hey, come on and help yourself. I gotta remember what it was like to be in my first AA meeting, my second AA meeting, my 10th AA meeting, and say, you are welcome here, but don't believe me when I say it. Let me show you with my actions that you're welcome here. Here's where you get coffee. Here's the bathroom. If you have trouble finding the place, you want to grab a seat with me? This is where I'm sitting. I'm up front because I like to hear the speaker. Right? I want to go further and make somebody who's so unused to fitting in feel like, hey, you can fit in if you want. We got room for you. I mean, I want the door to be so open, so all the way open for anybody who has alcoholism. And then it often comes to be the case that when we talk about the third tradition, we get into a talk about the fifth tradition as well. And I'm going to go there. AA in the earliest days seemed like such an amazing answer for alcoholics that it was natural to wonder, well, couldn't we help other people? Is this 12 step? We took these steps, you know, we took this process from people who didn't have alcoholism, we applied it to us. Couldn't everybody benefit from this? I mean, the earliest days, the alcoholics were bringing their non-alcoholic wives into the meetings. Everybody was doing the process. They're doing deflation, confession of defects, restitution. They're doing it. The whole family was getting better. Wives were getting better. It was before there was an Al-Anon. And it seemed a natural thought. Why couldn't we just apply this program to everybody? People hurt all over the world. There's hurting people all over. There's people with all kinds of problems. Wouldn't it be great if they adopted spiritual principles? Wouldn't it be great if we shared this with everybody? And what we came to find out was that we must keep our focus on alcoholics. We wrote a pamphlet called Problems Other Than Alcohol in 1958. This was not a new problem. It was written in 1958, where we had people, non-alcoholic drug addicts, coming to AA. And we had to draw a line and say, unfortunately, and this is the problem with the fifth tradition. So the third tradition says the door is open for anybody with alcoholism. We can't exclude anybody with alcoholism. The fifth tradition is a tough one because the fifth tradition says you can't make an AA member out of a non-alcoholic. That's tough. We have to close a door that feels like it should be open. The fifth step has a, I'm sorry, the fifth tradition has a real problem. It doesn't feel right. It feels un-AA to tell somebody this might not be the right place for you. Now there's people who have alcoholism and other problems. We have plenty of those. There's no shortage of those. All those people with alcoholism can come here. We prefer that they keep their discussion to alcoholism because we want something that everybody in the room can relate to. We prefer you don't talk about those outside issues here. That gets to the thing of conformity. Damn it, conform. Stop talking about that in an AA meeting. We don't have a means to enforce it, but that's what we do. And out of necessity, AA must remain a place where any alcoholic around the world can walk in and say, yep, I got that. I drink like that. I relate to that. If we get too far out of our swim lane, we run the risk of losing people and them coming in saying, well, these people don't understand how I feel. They've got problems other than alcoholism. So we try to keep the discussion to the fifth tradition. It feels tough. It feels wrong. It feels unwarm and fuzzy. But I've seen it handled in a lot of different ways in AA. And I don't know how your group does it. I'll tell you, we had a, you know, sometimes when I go to a meeting, when somebody asks me to lead a meeting, especially if it's a discussion meeting, if I get there early, I'll ask them, be like, well, what do you do if somebody raises their hand and introduces themselves as an addict? Do you let them share? I don't know. I look up in the directory, is this an open meeting or a closed meeting? How does the group handle it? I know how I think it should be handled, but I'm a guest at somebody else's meeting. So I'll ask them. 99% of the time, they have no answer. Nobody has any idea. They don't know. They just kind of make it up as they go along. What we have certainly found, what I've seen is people who don't have alcoholism don't stay. It just doesn't work out in the long term. You know, it comes to pass. But there are groups that are a little more formal with it. They say, hey, you know, AA is a great place to be if you have alcoholism. If you don't have alcoholism, there's other fellowships that you can go to. We're happy to give you information about that. We can even hook you up with a ride if you need it, you know, and they have like NA directories ready. I went to another meeting where a guy raised his hand and said, I'm so and so, I'm an addict. And the guy in the back said, are you also an alcoholic? The guy was like, yep, I just forgot how I'm supposed to introduce myself. I'm like, okay, cool, great. Talk about your alcoholism. I thought that was handled very well. There was no drama, but they made it clear Alcoholics Anonymous is a place for alcoholics. And when we do that, we can preserve our message in a way that I hope will resonate for generations to come. We're not done making alcoholics. There's going to be more to come. And so the third tradition says we can refuse entry to none who have alcoholism, but you can't make a non-alcoholic into an AA member in the fifth tradition. And it's tough. And again, it feels wrong. It doesn't feel right. It's such a warm, welcoming place until we get to that fifth tradition. Now, I'll tell you this. I didn't know whether or not I had alcoholism when I came to AA. So I came to meetings and I'm very clear at this. And I've just given you this whole speech where I've been the tough guy. I'm gonna kick you, I'm gonna throw you out of AA. Like Alec, this guy Alec, he's gonna throw you out of AA if you have alcoholism. No, not necessarily. Because I also like to say things like, if you're not sure whether or not you have alcoholism, there's no better place in the world, in my opinion, than in a meeting of AA to find out whether or not you have this thing. I'll tell you what I love more than anything. When somebody raises their hand, it's like their first meeting, and they say, my name's Alec, I don't know what I am. And I'm like, God bless you. Thank God you're here. Thank God you're here trying to sort it out instead of what I did when the bed was spinning every night. Do I have alcoholism or not? Do I go to AA or not? Can I get better on my own? Do I need to ask for help? Thank God you're here. Come on in. We love people who aren't sure whether or not they're alcoholic, and we're trying to sort it out. And that's great. You can do it in the meeting. You can do it afterwards. Like, let's go out and grab some coffee. I'd like to tell you what it was like for me being unsure whether or not I had alcoholism. I thought I was one of the worst drunks in my circle of friends. And then I came to AA and everybody's story was worse than mine. And I felt like a lightweight again. I mean, I'd been hating myself for years. And then I came to AA and I hated myself even more because I wasn't a bad enough alcoholic. I was like, I'm like the loser's loser and there's no place for me. And now I want to tell people what that felt like, because I'll find people who are in that spot and I'll tell them, I know exactly what that feels like. It's awful. You need an answer. You're not sure if AA is the answer. You're not sure if you even qualify to be here. My story is not that bad. I got sober when I was 19. I was embarrassed for a while to talk about the circumstances that I got sober under. Let me tell you how uncool it is being in an AA meeting and say my parents were paying for college when I got sober. It's degrading. It's awful. That doesn't get you any cool points in AA. I was embarrassed. I was willing to lie. Was absolutely willing to do that. I was willing to make up a worse version of my story so that I'd fit in. But we don't do that here in AA. We share the truth about ourselves. So the fifth step really comes down to being open and honest about what I am and how I came to that conclusion. We're not going to brainwash you. Don't tell us what you think we want to hear. Don't say you're an alcoholic just because you want to fit in. Tell us if you're not sure. I'm not sure. I know my drinking's bad. I got other problems too. Great. Let's talk about it. Let's grab a cup of coffee and find out what's going on with you. Maybe you have alcoholism. Maybe you don't. Maybe you're not even ready. Maybe you're like me in that last year of my drinking. God, I hate AA. I'll do anything to not end up here. And I just needed to find out that every other door was closed to me. And then we got to the third tradition. The AA door was wide open. I've been blessed beyond measure by being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been changed, like I said in the beginning. My values are different. When the Big Book talks about a spiritual awakening or spiritual experience, it talks about change in values, change in beliefs, principles, attitudes, actions that these men take. All of those things have changed for me very, very slowly, incrementally, glacially slow sometimes. But I've been welcome here as a member, and I've found a place for myself. And if you're not there, and if you're uncomfortable tonight, whether it's because you're new or because life is just being life, I hope that you give it another shot. I hope that you've heard something here tonight or seen something here, or maybe it has nothing to do with me. Honestly, the best part might've been your ride here. That was the best part for me, the 2 hours in the car with these clowns. And maybe you found something that will help you come back and give AA one more day. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks for my sobriety. Yeah.